For the last 4 months, this microscopic organism has changed our lives, hasn't it? And changed the lives of the entire world in pretty significant ways. So we sit here in a half-empty church with face masks on, and we're all tired of talking about it. But even when I say 4 months, most of us probably say, really? It hasn't been like 2 years? It seems much longer than just 4 months, but it's been just 4 months, really, that we've been impacted by it here. And we're all tired of talking about it, so I'm going to talk about it for a few more minutes. And there have been more responses, or as many responses to the coronavirus as there are people in the world, I think. And many people see it as an irritating inconvenience on the norms of life. Others see it as a major threat. And still others, I think, and I've heard, see it as a, and are certain that it's something deeper, that it's actually a sign or a judgment of God upon humanity. Have you heard that or seen that out there? That is what's going on here. Something akin to the biblical plagues of Exodus or Numbers or First Chronicles or Joel or Revelation. There's a lot of plagues in the Bible. So it's not unheard of that God would send a plague as an act of judgment. So the question is, has he? Is that what's going on here? And this question actually finds an interesting parallel in the 9th chapter of John. So that's where I'm going to start this morning, actually in the New Testament, in the book of John. One of my favorite stories of Jesus, one of my favorite Jesus stories, we find John chapter 9. Jesus is walking with his disciples, likely walking through the temple, and they come across this blind beggar. And here's how the story begins. In John chapter 9, we're just going to look at the first couple verses here. As he passed by, or as Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" So just let that sink in for a second. You see somebody, they've been blind their whole life. Is that the first question you ask? Probably not normally, but that's what the disciples ask. Who sinned, this man or his parents? And this question brings up a couple of points that will help us unpack Job's conversation with his friends that we're going to look at over the next couple of weeks. And the first thing that arises, the first idea that arises out of this question is this, is that their question reveals that they have faulty theological assumptions or faulty beliefs or understandings about God and how God works in the world. So they don't come to Jesus and ask a question that we might ask, like, why? Why was this man born blind? Did somebody sin? Was it a result of somebody's sin? Or was it an accident? Or was it all part of God's plan? Or was it Satan? Why? I think that's the question most of us would be inclined to ask. But instead, the disciples ask the question, who sinned? In other words, they're saying, we know why. We just want to know who to blame. Who can we point fingers at here? Was it his parents? Did they do something really bad before he was born and are being punished by it by having a blind son? Or, here's the interesting part, did this man somehow sin in vitro, in the uterus, in the womb? And that was a belief that somebody could sin in the womb and as a result be born with deformities or handicaps or things wrong with them. So their question assumes that a particular instance of physical suffering is necessarily correlated with a particular sin. Okay? They just want to know what the sin was. They want to know whose sin it was, who is at fault. So they start out and they show in their question that they have some misunderstandings of God and the way that he works in the world, some faulty theological assumptions. Secondly, their question shows an utter lack of compassion for a suffering human being. Someone who is like them, one of their fellow humans who's suffered their entire life. This man's blindness would have cut him off and affected him in so many ways. He wouldn't have been able to have a productive trade or work, and so he was relegated to begging and thus to poverty. His blindness would have also had some social effects on how people saw him, what they understood about him, what they believed about his character. It would have been seen as a curse. The disciples' question makes that evident. In many parts of the world, handicapped children are hidden away, even today, hidden away in the home, or abandoned to orphanages, or even some in the ancient world especially left to die because of cultural beliefs that were associated with disease and with suffering. And so the disciples' question shows that they have little concern for this man as a man. And they're regarding him I see them in lab coats with clipboards. No offense, Dr. Nauer. And they're just kind of using him as fodder, as an object lesson for their theological education. You know, it's much easier for us to abstract suffering, to explain suffering away, than it is to actually enter into suffering and help people carry it. Well-defined answers, having an answer and having all the boxes checked and knowing exactly what's happening, being able to explain and control, that's easy. But open-ended availability to other human beings in their suffering, that's excruciatingly difficult. And if we face it, we're all uncomfortable with suffering. We want to lighten it up. We want to wish it away. We want to be able to explain it, to control it, to ease our minds by hunting down a reason for it. But perhaps that's not the reason God intends for our suffering. Perhaps he intends for us to suffer to make us better comforters. All you have to do is read 2 Corinthians chapter 1 to see that. Perhaps God intends suffering so that we can be better comforters. And I'll say this, unlike Job's friends. We're going to explore this long conversation that Job has with his three friends. This is the majority of the book of Job, 29 chapters. We're going to do 29 chapters over 2 weeks. I was going to do it just today, so you're welcome. And we're going to break it up along the lines of these two observations that I just made from John chapter 9. First, we're going to look at these friends' faulty theological assumptions and the conclusions that they make. And then next week, we'll come back and we'll look at their lack of compassion. And from this, I hope that we can learn a little bit more about what it means to be a good friend. And it's not like Job's friends were helpless. It's not like we can't give them any credit. In fact, just the simple fact that they show up says a lot. So we have to give them some credit just for showing up. And oftentimes when our friends or our family members, people we know are suffering, the best thing that we can possibly do is just show up. Just be there. And it helps probably just to keep our mouths shut. So let's look at Job chapter 2, verse 11. So we're backing up a little bit. Most of our conversation will start in Job chapter 3. But Job chapter 2, verse 11, when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, which we've looked at over the last couple weeks, they came, each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They made an appointment together to come and show him sympathy and to comfort him. So they have these really good initial intentions. They want to show Job sympathy. They want to show him comfort. And then when they show up, they're shocked by what they see. Verse 12. When they saw Job from a distance, they did not even recognize him. This should remind us of Jesus and what Isaiah says about him in Isaiah chapter 52 and 53, that he was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and that his appearance was so marred, it was so broken through his suffering beyond human semblance. His form was beyond that of the children of mankind. So just as Jesus' disciples, after he was scourged and crucified, wouldn't have even been able to recognize him. That's what Job looks like. They arrived to find him unrecognizable because of his great suffering. And this is how they respond in the last half of chapter, verse 12, chapter 2. They raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes, and they sprinkled dust on their head toward heaven. So they see their friend suffering, and it breaks them, and they actually enter into that suffering with him. They identify with him. Like him, they tear their robes. Like him, they throw ash on their heads, and they stay with him for an extended period of grief. Verse 13, they sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they all saw that his suffering was very great. I mean, could you imagine sitting there in the ground in dust and ashes for 7 days with your friends and not needing to go to like McDonald's to get something? Can I just make a meal right now? They sit there and they commiserate with him. And 7 days was an appropriate extent of mourning when someone died. And they're mourning in a way as if Job had died. And he probably looked like he was on the brink of death. Like they're looking at the machine and waiting for it to flatline. Perhaps they thought that he would die. But at a minimum, their response shows the depth of Job's suffering and also their willingness to simply be with him in it. And if Job, the book of Job, had stopped at chapter 2 after this description of his friends, we would have all thought they were amazing. But chapter 3 and 4 and the rest comes. And we see in this dialogue with his friends, first of all, we see a really long conversation. And I want to get a picture of that conversation by showing you the structure of it. Now, this is a poem, and it's a very beautifully, masterfully crafted and structured poem. And these next 29 chapters have a really clear structure that will help us understand what's going on here. So I'll just lay that out for you real quickly. First of all, in Job chapter 3, Job just opens the whole thing up. We looked at this last week with the lament over the day he was born, wishing it had never happened. And then chapter 4, we see basically round 1. This is like a boxing match here. Round 1, where Eliphaz speaks and then Job responds. And Bildad speaks and Job responds. And Zophar speaks and Job responds. And we see three of these rounds. First is in chapters 4 through 14. The second is almost identical in chapters 15 to 21. And each of them are heightened. They're emotionally heightened. People are getting angrier, they're calling each other names, and they're kind of getting shorter and more pointed. And then the final round in chapters 22 to 27, it's different than the others in that Zophar doesn't even speak. This third friend, he's so done with the conversation at this point, he's like, I'm not even going to talk. There's no more reasoning with this guy. So we have Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job in chapters 22 to 27. And then it ends with Job summarizing everything in chapters 28 to 31 and kind of a summary defense, his closing arguments. So that structure to me helps give me some handles for how to understand this conversation. And at the end, finally, all of the arguments are exhausted, and the book moves on from there. So what do Job's friends bring to the table? What is their argument? What are they saying to Job? And we'll find, I think, that all three of them, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, are really saying the same things. They're just saying them in different ways. They have different emphases, different things that are important to them, but they're all really saying the same thing. That's what we're going to unpack over the next 2 weeks. And they have this kind of coordinated attack against Job. And so instead of going through the book verse by verse or chapter by chapter or even character by character or round by round, we're just going to look at these basically four main themes that come out from the friends. And it's important to realize that these friends really represent the collected wisdom of centuries of ancient Near Eastern culture. And especially the wisdom of ancient Israel that we find that's laid out for us in the book of Proverbs. And so these men in some way embody a strict reading of the book of Proverbs. If everything in Proverbs was law, this is what it would look like. And it begins with this, what I call retribution theology, or in other words, you reap what you sow. So at the foundation of their case against Job, these three friends share this fundamental tenet of wisdom, best labeled retribution theology. It's basically the belief that if you're righteous, you'll get rewarded. And if you're wicked, you'll be punished. If you do good, you'll get rewarded. If you're a sinner, you'll get punished. So here's a sampling of this theology from Eliphaz from Job chapter 4. He says this, "Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same." So even there you see the sowing and reaping metaphor that actually the New Testament picks up. "By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they are consumed." Now as a basic moral rule, retribution is actually a biblical idea. It's throughout the Bible. You go back to Deuteronomy, you see it all over the place. You see it in Proverbs. You see it in the Psalms, in the prophets. Even Jesus and the Apostle Paul recognize and understand it. That God sends blessing and God sends judgment. That God sends good and God sends evil. And that people get what they, in some ways, deserve. But with Job's friends, this idea of reaping and sowing, of retribution, takes kind of a sinister turn, because what they do is they make it rigid. They make it into an unbreakable mechanistic law, like a vending machine. You put your good quarters out and you get your good snacks out. Put your good quarters in, get your good snacks out. You put your bad quarters in, you get your bad snacks out, like vegetables, right? So it's mechanistic in a sense. And morality in this idea, in this understanding, is not personal. It's not relational, like based on a relationship with God, but it's predictable, it's definable, it's repeatable. And to change these universal laws of retribution would be like asking the earth to stop spinning. Bildad looks at these, this idea in Job chapter 18, verse 4. He's speaking to Job and he says, "You who tear yourself in your anger, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or the rock be removed out of its place?" In other words, he's saying, here's these laws. If you do evil, you're going to get punished. You're going to suffer. If you do good, you're going to be blessed. And Job, you're so angry, you think God should change those laws for you? That would be like asking the earth to stop, or like asking those mountains to move over. It's not going to happen. So for Bildad, he has a view that God is just, and he certainly is just. And if God is just, then evil people will always suffer, and good people will always be blessed. Period. End of story. And Job even responds to this to his friends by pointing out some instances when an unwavering retribution theology just simply does not hold true. So chapter 12, verse 6, he says, "The tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure, who bring their God in their hand." These idolatrous people who worship idols, they're secure. These robbers are at peace. We see evil people in strong places, in getting blessing. Chapter 21, verse 7, Job says again, "Why do the wicked live? Why do they reach old age and grow mighty in power?" These are much the same questions and observable injustices in the world that so bothered the teacher of Ecclesiastes, if you remember his complaints as well. So retribution theology is the first thing they bring. You reap what you sow all the time, one for one. There's always a distinct mechanical exchange. And the next mistake they make, or the next thing they bring towards Job, is what I call logical gymnastics. In other words, you have to be really flexible and be able to bend some rules of logic to get where they get in their thinking. So the basic conclusion that these friends reach with Job, and they hold it unflinchingly to the end, they will not drop it, they will not change their mind, is that the only explanation for Job's great suffering is Job's great sin. So the only reason that you're suffering is because you've sinned. Suffering is necessarily a result of sin. So I'm going to give you a little logical syllogism here, and here's their logic. They have a first premise. It's this. If someone sins, then they will suffer the consequences, right? That's retribution theology. Reap what you sow. Here's one verse that sums that up. The wicked man writhes in pain all his days. Job 15:20. So if someone sins, then they will suffer the consequences. The second premise is this. Job has suffered greatly. And this is just a given. They've watched that. It's been stated. They understood Job's suffering is great. Okay, so now from these two premises, these two statements, they're going to make a conclusion, which is this. Job's great suffering is a result of his great sin. Okay, if someone sins, they will suffer the consequences. Job has suffered greatly, therefore Job has sinned. You see the logic? Does it make sense to you? Okay, here's where they go with this. Job 22:4-5. Is it for your fear of him that he reproves you and enters into judgment with you? Is not your evil abundant? There is no end to your iniquities. They come out and say this to Job. There's no end. You're the most sinful person I've ever met. Because I see all the great suffering that you have. Okay, and what is actually happening here is... People like Aristotle and other logicians of history would roll over in their graves if they saw someone do this, because this argument in formal logic is actually known as a non sequitur.
So the friends arrive at this faulty conclusion, and now their task, they take it upon themselves to uncover precisely what Job's sin is. So they're detectives trying to hunt out exactly what Job has done wrong. And they begin kind of suggestively in Job chapter 5. For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground, but man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upwards. In other words, what they're saying to Job is that your suffering didn't just come from nowhere. God must be disciplining you for something. So what is it? Fess up, Job. And the friends appeal to this kind of universal reality of human sin to convince Job of the errors of his ways. So here's Bildad in Job 25, verse 4. How then can man be in the right before God? How can he who is born of woman be pure? And then Zophar presses the case even further, and he argues that Job probably deserves actually worse than he's gotten. So in Job 11:6, he's not compassionate at all, by the way. He's pretty hardcore. He's like, know then, this is like his opening statement, know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. And then by the end of these speeches, Eliphaz is so flustered with Job and his unwillingness to confess that he makes up a list of sins that Job must have committed. He says, well, here's all, since you won't confess, I'll confess for you. Job chapter 22, verses 6 to 9. For you have exacted pledges of your brothers for nothing and stripped the naked of their clothing. You've given no water to the weary to drink. You've withheld bread from the hungry. The man with power possessed the land and the favored man lived in it. You have sent widows away empty and the arms of the fatherless were crushed. So, and he just lists sin after sin after sin that Job must have committed. These guys are so committed to this idea that suffering can only come from specific sins that they back Job into this corner that he must have sinned. So what do we do all with all of this? And I truly believe that the book of Job is a great gift to us. As much as we love to read ancient Hebrew poetry, and as much as we love these long dialogues, well, they're just confusing to us. It's actually a great gift to us because it clearly teaches us two things. It clearly teaches us several things, two of which today we're going to look at might help us to rethink our theological assumptions or our own basic beliefs about God and how he relates to the world, and also what we do with the truth that we understand. And the first basic thing we learn from Job is that suffering is not always caused by sin. Yes, sin has brought suffering into our world. So it's not beyond the bounds of orthodoxy or right, truthful thinking to blame all suffering on sin in general. Okay, there wouldn't be suffering in the world if humanity hadn't fallen. And the suffering that we do endure in the world is definitely a result of living in a fallen world. The coronavirus is a case in point. So there's virtually no way for us to rightfully say it's a particular judgment of God, though it certainly is part of living life in a fallen world. The book of Job does clearly teach us that not every particular instance of suffering is the direct result of a particular sin. So there's a difference between generalities and particularities, right? Because if that were the case, I mean, just think about the New Testament for a moment. If it were the case that every particular suffering was a result of a particular sin, it'd be really difficult to explain Jesus. How do you look at Jesus suffering on the cross and go, like, well, he must have done something wrong? I mean, I guess you can go, yeah, we did something wrong, and those are the particular sins that put him on the cross, but he didn't deserve it. It would be very difficult to explain the righteous suffering of Job, the apostles, every Christian who has ever suffered for their faith. And it only takes one careful reading of the book of 1 Peter to get really clear on this issue. And I encourage you to go and read that book this week. He talks very much about suffering very clearly. Now, there are many, I think, modern theological traditions and practices that lean towards this retribution theology. It's often a component of what we call the prosperity gospel or prosperity theology, in which suffering may not always necessarily be seen as a result of a specific sin. Oftentimes, Satan is what causes suffering. But then on the other end of it, to receive healing, one must have a requisite amount of faith. And if healing doesn't take place, then what's wrong? Something's wrong with your faith. And if those with great faith, who have great faith and even greater works, then they should have greater reward, greater prosperity. And you can discern in this just the very subtle ways that this unflinching retribution theology that Job's friends brings rears its ugly head in the church today. So I'd encourage you to be careful with that. The second thing that I would take away from this is that life is too complex for simplistic answers. Life is too complex for simplistic answers. We simply don't know it all. And it's very tempting, as you read Job's friends and what they say, it's very tempting to agree with their theology. It's very tempting to agree with what they believe or say about God. They have a lofty view of God. Their theology oftentimes seems really solid, and yet they completely miss the mark. And so the question is, why? Why do they so miss the mark, even though they have a grasp on truth? And I think the first answer to this question is that these men and us, what we do so often is that we desire to control God. We want to control him. We want to put him in a box. And that can be a really big box. It can be a really lofty box, but if it limits God in any way, then it also limits our understanding of how the world works, how suffering works. It limits our understanding of morality, of people, and of how God relates to his world. Because it's so much easier, friends, it's so much easier to have a simplistic, mechanistic moral formula than it is to actually walk in living relationship with God. And to walk through suffering with people. And the book of Job stands for us as a corrective to a simplistic reading of Proverbs. And a corrective to a mechanistic attempt to control God or understand God completely. So Job's friends end up being an epic fail. They knew true things, but they didn't know the truth. They knew true things, but they didn't know the truth, and they end up misusing truth in a destructive way. And can we do that? Brothers and sisters, can we take truth and wield it like a club on people? Just because you know something true about God, just because you have the truth in Jesus Christ, doesn't mean you get to use it willy-nilly however you want, like a bull in a china shop. It means that you use it lovingly and wisely. One of the greatest lessons that we can learn from the book of Job is that good theology can be used poorly and destructively. And part of our walking with God and with others is learning how to use the truth we know in a way that edifies and builds up and draws people toward their Savior. And sometimes we simply will never know the answers, and we have to be okay with uncertainty, with unpredictability, with letting God out of the box we want to put him in. Because Job's God, the God of the book of Job, is neither controllable nor understandable completely. And Job takes a humble but an honest approach to his own suffering, and so should we. Because life and God are both too complex to pridefully waste them with easy answers. Would you pray with me? Jesus, we come to you this morning, and we're thankful for technology, and we're thankful for your grace on us when it breaks. And we're thankful more than that, though, for your word, and that it draws us up in our shortcomings. It points out our pride. It points out the ways that we want to control you and others and the world. We want to have answers for questions that sometimes we shouldn't even be asking. And we forget to ask the questions that we ought to. And so, God, lead us into truth, lead us into wisdom. Help us to understand the truth and love people with it instead of beating people with it. God, give us a perspective on the suffering of others and the suffering of ourselves that is biblical, that's solid, and that leaves room for you to be the God that you are, a God that we can't control or predict. God, we're so thankful that you are who you are. We tremble before that today, and yet we're grateful too for Jesus, who died for our sins, who took them on himself, who took on the suffering of others that we might have life, that we might avoid your Father's wrath. Jesus, we thank you for freely choosing suffering in our place. And we give you all of the praise, all of the credit, all the worship, all the glory this morning. Amen.